This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I want to talk to you today about an important moment in history when the survival of Western civilization was under threat. The fate of the nation, and in some ways the fate of the world, depended on the sacrifice of just a few thousand men. They were called the Few. Most of them were about college age. This wasn't that long ago, but it was a time when college-age men were considered men. They were given manly duties and expected to carry them out. The life-threatening strife and adversity brought out the very best in these men. This is a story about a battle that changed world history. It occurred during World War II in Britain, the summer of 1940. A historic battle, the only battle to be fought entirely in the air, and it has come to be known as the Battle of Britain. It was a battle against the German Luftwaffe by 2,936 British pilots. Some say that it came down to the efforts of about 1,000 young men, most of whom were under 21 years old. Winston Churchill put it this way on June 18, 1940, speaking before the British Parliament.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire.
This is an awesome, dramatic, inspiring chapter in Britain's history, and it has some important lessons for us today. We are living in historic times. Much is at stake. Whether or not people realize it, Bible prophecy shows that this world is on the brink of World War III, and it's going to be worse than any war in history. God has given His people the job of warning this world and trying to wake people up to this threat. And it's a difficult job. In fact, it is a great spiritual war. We need to think and act like warriors to do this work. And at the same time, each of us fights an individual war against our personal lives, against Satan, against society, and against the self, the evil human nature within ourselves. We must fight, Gerald Fleury wrote in The Former Prophets. We must fight to do spiritual battle every day. We have to fight to remain faithful to the great God. We have to fight to get our prayer in. As Paul wrote in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 12, fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life. In a lot of ways, the fate of the world depends on just a few thousand, many of whom are very young, and who carry a lot of responsibility. God's people today are the few, a small group of elite spiritual soldiers. This is a real battle, but we live in a soft age, a lukewarm age. Our militaries are disarming. We're cozying up to dictators. We're pretending like terrorist groups and nations can be bargained with. That's the spirit of the age. And each one of us is in danger of absorbing that spirit and losing our fighting spirit. Leading up to World War II, that was the spirit that pervaded in Britain. World War I had been so devastating, no one thought it would ever happen again. The Germans were forbidden to have an air force, and people assumed the threat was over. But behind the scenes, the Germans were very active. Training military pilots in civil aviation schools, training pilots at a secret school in Russia, building up the commercial airline Lufthansa that could use its schools for military training, its pilots, its airfields for the military. German aircraft manufacturers could easily convert commercial planes into bombers. By the time Hitler took power in January 1933, he had an air force of 20,000 men. He immediately broke the limitations of the Versailles Treaty and had Germany's aircraft industry start producing military planes. Within a year, they were producing 160 military planes every month. Meanwhile, Britain was focusing on disarmament. They had fewer than 500 planes, mostly wood and canvas biplanes that were obsolete. The British didn't recognize how serious the danger was that was rising in Germany. It seems that Israel has always been susceptible to this weakness. As in the time of David, anciently, when the Philistine warrior challenged the Israelites, it says in 1 Samuel 17 that all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. The Israelites were led by a weak king who lacked faith. The soldiers followed that poor example, that faithless leadership. In the modern-day nations of Israel, America, and Britain, biblical prophecy says that God has broken the pride of our nation's power. We see horrifying tragedies today in America and Britain, Gerald Flory wrote in his book, The Former Prophets. Shouldn't these tragedies cause strong men to rise up in wrath and strength? But there is usually silence. The question is, why? Well, that prophecy found in Leviticus 26 and verse 19 answers that question. Nevertheless, those who do God's work today must be mighty spiritual warriors to do the job God gives us to do, and even to conquer in our personal spiritual battles. We need to be like young David, who watched the fearful soldiers around him and spoke up, "What shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" God was real and alive to David, and he saw Israel's armies as God's armies. He was eager to fight Goliath. He wanted to show the world just how powerful the great God really is. And this young man asked the profound question, is there not a cause? In the modern nations of Israel, so many people don't recognize a cause worth fighting for. We can never win a war that we don't believe in. We can never do the work of God without having David's attitude and seeing the monumental cause that we stand for. Winston Churchill really had to fight just to get the nation on his side, for the nation to brace for war. He was finally able to convince Britain's leaders that Germany was a genuine threat. In July 1934, Parliament voted to expand the Royal Air Force. So from that point until the war started, September 1st, 1939, it was a race between Britain and Germany for air supremacy. The Germans had a huge advantage. Not only did they have a significant head start in building their air force, but the nation was a dictatorship led by a tyrant with a single-minded focus who was pouring tremendous resources into building the military. Britain, on the other hand, was democratic, and it had to contend with a lot of people who opposed the arms buildup. By the start of the war, Britain had about 660 fighter planes. The German Luftwaffe had more than 3,600 bombers and fighters. The odds favored Germany about 5-1. On top of that, air warfare made Britain a sitting duck. Churchill called London the greatest target in the world, a kind of tremendous fat cow tied up to attract the beasts of prey. Large parts of England could be reached within 20 minutes by bombers that took off from the continent. and it would take the Brits 10 minutes or more to get a plane off the ground to operational altitude to be able to intercept those enemy fighters. In 1939, Germany invaded Poland. Great Britain and France responded by declaring war on Germany. But there were still a lot of the British who were apathetic about what was happening. The next spring, Neville Chamberlain resigned as Prime Minister, and Winston Churchill took over. The same day, Germany attacked Holland, Belgium, and France in a fierce blitzkrieg. The Germans overwhelmed Holland in 5 days and Belgium in 17 days. Just a little over a month later, they entered Paris, and France surrendered within a week. At that point, Britain was basically alone. Suddenly, the Brits began to understand just how serious the threat was. They could see that they were going to be Hitler's next target. Churchill's speeches took on new meaning for them. That's when Churchill gave that speech before Parliament, June 18th, 1940.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war.
The British were up against a very ruthless, powerful, and determined enemy. Hitler was going to concentrate all his firepower on this one nation.
If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
When young David approached Goliath on that ancient battlefield, he spoke to him with shocking boldness. You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Eternal of Hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day will the Eternal deliver you into my hand, and I will smite you and take your head from you, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and all this assembly shall know that the Eternal saves not with a sword and spear, for the battle is the Eternal's, and he will give you into our hands. This young man was filled with faith. He knew that God was alive. Do you see how we can impact the world today with this kind of faith in the living God? Gerald Flory wrote, David was motivated to fight Goliath so that all the earth may know there's a God in Israel. Oh, how Britain, America, and Judah need to hear that message today. They need to know that there's a God in Israel. What problem are you facing that you can't handle? He continued. No matter how gigantic it is, there is no problem you can't handle if you face it the way David did. We can conquer anything if the battle is the Eternal's. Trust God and face your problems in faith, and God will deliver you. This is not just a nice slogan or cute formula. I'm talking about having faith in the living God, trusting God to do great things in your life. He has promised to do that, and he cannot lie. On May 14, 1940, Anthony Eden, Britain's Secretary of State for War, broadcast an appeal for the formation of a volunteer force of male civilians to help guard Britain against the threat of German parachute invaders. I'm reading from Ira Peck's book, The Battle of Britain. Even before he had finished speaking, thousands of men between the ages of 16 and 65 had rushed to local police stations to volunteer. Within 6 days, more than a quarter of a million had enrolled, and by August, this new citizens' army, later called the Home Guard, numbered more than a million. Now, that was a lot of men doing a very inspiring thing, volunteering to defend their country. The only trouble was they had very little equipment and armaments. About one-third of the volunteers were armed with rifles. The rest had such weapons as shotguns, sporting rifles, golf clubs, axes, pikes, and sticks. Meanwhile, the German parachutists had submachine guns and grenades. Even Britain's regular army was terribly underarmed. The chiefs of staff told Churchill that if the German force made it into England, they were in big trouble. They just didn't have enough offensive power to resist. They needed time to build their defenses up. And in order to buy that time, the Royal Air Force had to be able to repel a German air invasion. Everything depended on their ability to do this. The problem was the RAF had been hit hard in trying to help the French defend against the Germans. The head of the fighter command said that Britain needed at least 52 fighter squadrons at home to defend Britain. They were down to 37 squadrons. Britain was at practically its weakest militarily. Its armaments had been largely left behind on French soil. Of the entire British army, there remained but 100 tanks and about three very under-equipped divisions. Meanwhile, the Nazis had 45 highly trained divisions available and was ready to supply 65 more divisions. Had Hitler invaded at this point, the odds would have been overwhelmingly in his favor. The Germans had superiority of men and arms against the British at an incredible ratio of 32 to 1. Thankfully, Hitler delayed invading Britain for several weeks, giving them time to regroup for the Battle of Britain. What held Hitler back? It's pretty clear that this was a miracle from God. While Hitler hesitated, the British people rolled up their sleeves and went to work, wrote Ira Peck. Weeks of hectic activity followed as Britain steeled itself against invasion. War production began to climb steadily. In the factories, men worked long hours until, exhausted, they fell asleep at their machines. In homes, middle-aged women held filing parties after tea to smooth down the rough edges of machine parts. In school workshops, boys helped rim the edges of airplane seats with hammers that were too big for some of them to hold. The Navy was busy getting their destroyers ready, and the RAF was adding radar stations, building airfields, building planes, training pilots, constructing anti-aircraft guns. They hung balloons over cities and ports to deter low-flying enemy planes. They knew they were going to take the brunt of the German attack. Churchill told his people,
"I look forward confidently to the exploits of our fighter pilots, these splendid men, this brilliant youth, who will have the glory of saving their native land, their island home, and all they love from the most deadly of all attacks."
It hinged on the efforts of about 1,000 young men whose average age was 20 years old. These brave pilots came from all walks of life, says the Battle of Britain Historical Society. Many were trained and experienced, but most had come from civilian duties to become fighter pilots with RAF Fighter Command. So often, God is looking for warriors who are eager to fight. During Israel's history, in the time of the Judges, when the Israelites faced a battle against the Midianites, God instructed their leader, Gideon, to say to the army, "Whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart." And out of 32,000 soldiers, 22,000 left the battle, nearly 7 in 10 of them. The nation was so weak and faithless at that time, and God didn't want weak, fearful men on the battlefield. We must have courage to fight our battles. You can follow this story in Judges chapter 7 and see how God eliminated many more of these soldiers through a test. He brought them to the water and he watched to see how they drank from it. Those who set down their weapons, got down on their hands and knees, and lapped water like a dog, God culled from the army. He only retained those few who brought the water with their hand up to their mouth and remained vigilant. Only those who were eager to do battle and to go on the offensive. And out of 22,000 soldiers, there were only 300 of these men. It tends to be only a tiny minority that will truly embrace the rigors of warfare. Only the few who will take on that mighty and dangerous responsibility. None of us should underestimate the importance of our individual contribution. God is going to use every last eager soldier. He offers the glory of saving our native land and all we love from the most deadly of spiritual attacks if we eagerly go out and do our duty for God, King, and country. On June 5th of 1940, Germany began small air raids on England. In July, they increased their attacks significantly, and the RAF pilots went to work, hurling themselves against these German aircraft, and they often found themselves severely outnumbered. Imagine the emotion of these pilots. Here is how one British Spitfire pilot described how he felt when he saw the enemy.
"On sighting an overwhelmingly large enemy formation, there was a sort of hysterical humor at the hopelessness of the task, erased almost immediately by the onset of quick, stabbing shafts of fear as the armada of aircraft drew closer. And finally, before joining combat, a consciousness of a thudding and moist brow accompanied by a breathless, panicky fear."
These men had to face down their fear in order to do their job. Someone can look like a warrior, but it takes real faith to stand up to giants and other problems, Mr. Fleury wrote in The Former Prophets. Trials reveal who the real warriors are. We cannot fake this. When the big battle comes, who will stand up like David and fight for the living God? Proverbs 28 and verse 1 says that the righteous are bold as a lion. This is the key to being bold spiritual soldiers. We must be righteous. We have to build that righteousness so we have the boldness when we need it. We have to remember this and think about this in the little decisions that we make each day, working to build the very righteousness of God. Spiritual courage may be the greatest need, Gerald Fleury wrote in his book Malachi's Message. Without it, the other virtues are of little value. God's people can't cower in fear and still grow in God's love. like those British pilots. They had to love their country and their countrymen more than they feared the enemy. We have to love this world enough to conquer our fears. We have to love this world enough to conquer sin and build righteousness so we can be bold as lions. Hitler started making preparations for a ground invasion. He wanted to attack Britain's shipping capacity, to pulverize the towns on the coast that they would land on, and try to draw more British planes into battle to further reduce their numbers. The Germans were confident they could do the job in 2 to 4 weeks. Winston Churchill rallied the British with a rousing radio broadcast.
"And now it has come to us to stand alone in the breach and face the worst that the tyrant's might and enmity can do. Bearing ourselves humbly before God, but conscious that we serve an unfolding purpose, we are ready to defend our native land against the invasion by which it is threatened. We are fighting by ourselves alone, but we are not fighting for ourselves alone. Here in this strong city of refuge, which enshrines the title deeds of human progress and is of deep consequence to Christian civilization, here girt about by the seas and oceans where the Navy reigns, shielded from above by the prowess and devotion of our airmen, we await undismayed the impending assault."
To do our job, we must see the bigger cause. This world needs us to throw ourselves into our duties, our prayer life, our work, our daily character development, our support for the great work of God. What each one of us does is of deep consequence in the bigger picture. It's all too easy to underestimate the difference that your individual contribution makes. But we are not fighting for ourselves alone. We have many, many people depending on us. And we have help. We don't have to fear the impending assault. The Germans had been targeting factories and other targets on the ground, and they realized they weren't achieving what they had hoped. So they decided to concentrate their firepower and focus entirely on destroying the Royal Air Force. Hitler issued War Directive Number 17. The German air forces must, with all means in their power and as quickly as possible, destroy the English Air Force. They launched several attacks. They heavily bombed several British airfields. On August 15th, the Germans decided to try for a knockout blow. The Luftwaffe flew 1,786 sorties in a single day. But when the fighting was over for the day, the Luftwaffe had lost 76 planes. And Britain's fighter command lost less than half that, only 34 planes. The British fighters were faster and more easily maneuverable. And the British were showing themselves to be tough warriors. British pilots managed to stay in action. They got used to landing their planes on cratered runways, zigzagging around the holes. This truly was frustrating to Adolf Hitler. "The loss of fighter command pilots during this period was severe," wrote Ira Peck. "But it would have been worse if some had not been able to bail out of their planes or successfully crashed land them. Many pilots were able to get back into action again, some of them quite quickly." But the Germans kept coming. They seriously battered the British airfields. They were destroying British planes and pilots far faster than the Brits could replace them. Between August 24th and September 6th, 295 fighter planes were destroyed and 171 were badly damaged. 103 fighter command pilots were killed or missing, and 128 more were wounded. British Replacement pilots were often easy prey for the more experienced Luftwaffe pilots, wrote Ira Peck. As for the experienced fighter command pilots, the strain of flying 7 or 8 sorties a day was producing a terrible weariness in them. Fighter command was slowly but surely being bled to death. Only a miracle could save it from destruction. Some of the commanders felt like if the Germans maintained their bombing for another week, they would have been finished. The whole outcome of the war hinged on very close margins. But if you're going to succeed in warfare, you must be able to recover from a lost battle now and again. Just because you lose a battle doesn't mean you've lost the war. For some time, Germans had been dropping bombs on the outskirts of London just to try to demoralize the British. Hitler had forbidden them to bomb London itself. He was saving that as his trump card. But on August 24th, one pilot accidentally hit the center of London, probably because of a navigational error. Churchill didn't know it was an accident, so he responded by ordering a bombing of Berlin the next night and for several nights afterward. This infuriated Hitler, and he decided that the time had come to target London. It wasn't because it made sense militarily. He just became enraged and emotional, and thus all the firepower that very nearly wiped out the British fighter command was redirected to target London. This was extremely rough for London. The bombing on London started at 5:15 September 7th. The British weren't expecting the attack, and it did a lot of damage. Over 300 tons of high-explosive bombs and thousands of incendiaries were dropped on the slums of East End, the docks, the pubs. By the end of the day, London was on fire for miles. Then that night, as firemen were trying to put the fires out, the Germans came back. They used the fires as beacons to guide them and bombed for 7 more hours. Britain had practically no defenses for night raids. They did a terrible amount of damage. And that night, Hermann Göring said on German radio, "This is the historic hour when, for the first time, our Air Force delivered its thrust right into the enemy's heart." These bombings continued for several days. Germany was finishing plans for an invasion. Hitler felt they were on the cusp of victory. He still nurtured the dream that bombing would terrorize the British people and make them sue for peace. London endured the Blitz, over 2 months of almost nightly bombing by an average of 160 German bombers. The night of October 15th, 1940, more than 400 bombers dropped about 540 tons of explosives on the city, killing 400 people and injuring 800 others. It was a lot of terrible tragedy. That bombing ended up killing almost 20,000 people. But there were a couple of amazing aspects of what happened during the Blitz. First of all, the British people took it amazingly well. There was a lot of tragedy in the Blitz, yet there was another side, Ira Peck wrote. The people of London, of all classes, became much friendlier than ever before or perhaps ever since. People were thrown together with their neighbors and even perfect strangers in numerous situations, in air raid shelters, first aid stations, firefighting groups, and groups to repair each other's homes. People showed their friendship in other ways, too. They looked after each other's children, shared their stoves with less fortunate neighbors, and lent each other all kinds of necessities. There was kindness, there was sympathy, and there was understanding. Instances of panic were very rare in London throughout the entire period of the Blitz. While Hitler hoped for mass hysteria and the British government feared it, the people themselves remained remarkably calm and cheerful. During the Blitz, the number of Londoners with mental disorders actually declined. There were fewer suicides, much less drunkenness, and less disorderly conduct. The Apostle Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 4, "We are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, but not destroyed." We must have high morale in warfare, even in very difficult circumstances. The British people set a marvelous example in this respect. These bombings failed to break their spirit and end their will to fight. And a second remarkable thing about the Blitz was that when Hitler redirected his attack from the Air Force onto the city of London, he essentially saved the British Air Force. The British flying ace Tin Legs Bader, the legless English fighter pilot, led the RAF into the fray. The British airmen inflicted heavy losses on their German attackers. England regained the air superiority over Britain, which the Luftwaffe had almost seized prior to Hitler switching his air attack to London. This spared the British air bases and vital command posts from further damage. It gave them time to patch up their airfields and communication lines. This great mistake of Hitler's, born out of a fit of anger and a desire for revenge, literally cost the Nazi Air Force the advantage in the Battle of Britain and turned the tables in favor of the British. Again, the whole battle hinged on minute factors, just a few days' difference, bombing this area and not that area. But in the end, the decision to target London actually proved to be Hitler's undoing. David Gardner said this:
"It was then the really big miracle happened. At the very moment when they were right on the edge of final victory in the air, and when the German plans for invasion were complete, Hitler suddenly ordered the Luftwaffe to switch its attack to London. It saved Fighter Command. The German leadership had committed the most catastrophic blunder, and in so doing, had saved the day."
We need miracles if we are to prevail. We need God working things out for us to have victory in this spiritual warfare. Back to the height of the air battle in September 1940, King George VI perceived the threat of imminent invasion. He called a national day of prayer, September 8, 1940. Winston Churchill realized invasion was imminent. He spoke to the nation over radio. He spoke about historic successes of Lord Nelson and Sir Francis Drake, and he said this: "We have read about this in the history books, but what is happening now is on a far greater scale and of far more consequence to the life and future of the world and its civilization than these brave old days of the past. Every man and woman will therefore prepare himself to do his duty, whatever it may be, with special pride and care. It is with devout but sure confidence that I say, let God defend the right." These godly-oriented leaders motivated a nation to mass prayer to God for deliverance. Exactly 1 week later, the crisis of the Battle of Britain peaked. Hitler chose September 15th for one last big effort by the Luftwaffe to knock out Fighter Command. They began amassing formations off the coast of France that morning to mount its heaviest ever attack on the British defenses. Successive waves of Luftwaffe fighters and bombers. The British anticipated the attack and threw everything they had up in the air at them, every single fighter plane available, into the pitched battle. All day long, there were great battles taking place in the skies over southeast England. Crowds on the ground watched as it all unfolded. At the height of battle, Churchill visited group headquarters of the No. 11 group, commanded by Keith Park. He wrote this: "I became conscious of the anxiety of the commander. I had watched in silence. I now asked, What other reserves have we? There are none, said Air Vice Marshal Park. In an account which he wrote about it afterward, he said that, at this I looked grave. Well, I might. What losses should we not suffer if our refueling planes were caught on the ground by further raids of 40-plus or 50-plus? The odds were great. Our margins small. The stakes infinite. Imagine a handful of college boys being thrown into battle and realizing that the survival of the nation depends on their success. Surely you would be anxious and praying, and at the same time filled with admiration and appreciation watching these young men throw themselves into the jaws of death. So much hinged on the efforts of so few. The same is true of God's work in this end time. There are so few of us, but we do have God with us. 1 Chronicles 12 and verse 8 has a fantastic description of the people that God needs in this intense spiritual warfare. And of the Gadites, there separated themselves unto David into the hold to the wilderness, men of might and men of war, fit for the battle, that could handle shield and buckler, whose faces were like the faces of lions and were as swift as the roes upon the mountains. That is what we need to be today, Gerald Flory wrote. God has called us to be spiritual soldiers. We are here to take on the worst Goliath of all time, Satan the devil in his worst wrath. We must be fit for this spiritual battle. We have to see ourselves as spiritual warriors for God, fighting a good fight. That can take a lot of effort. It's difficult to keep that in mind day to day, moment by moment, the same way that a soldier would who is on a physical battlefield looking his enemy in the eye. On that fateful day, those few British pilots, only about 1,000 of them, did a tremendous job battling back the German assault. By the end of the day, the Luftwaffe had lost 60 planes, Fighter Command only 26. And that was after the Germans had lost 140 other planes the previous week. This was a stunning blow to the Germans, wrote Ira Peck. Even the Luftwaffe could not afford to lose planes at such a rate. Furthermore, the fighter command had shown conclusively that it was not about to be driven from the air. The Luftwaffe commanders, once supremely confident, were now shaken. The German Navy, never keen on invading England, was now even less keen. The Army, confident earlier that it could do its part once the Luftwaffe had won air supremacy, was now having doubts of its own. Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding wrote this in the Birmingham Daily Post, June 8, 1942.
At the end of the battle, one had the feeling that there had been some special divine intervention to alter some sequence of events which would otherwise have occurred. I see that this intervention was no last-minute happening. It was all part of the mighty plan. I say with absolute conviction that I can trace the intervention of God not only in the battle itself, but in the events which led up to it, and that if it had not been for this intervention, the battle would have been joined in conditions which, humanly speaking, would have rendered victory impossible.
After the defeat of that day, Hitler decided to postpone an invasion of England indefinitely. This turned out to be the decisive battle that repelled Germany from Great Britain. As Douglas Bader said, 15th September was the day that the battle was won. Britain had been saved chiefly by about 1,000 boys and young men who flew for fighter command. This is what inspired Winston Churchill to say, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. Oddly enough, at the time of this epic battle, the men who fought it had little idea of its importance, Ira Peck wrote. It is very unlikely that any Royal Air Force fighter pilot ever said or even thought, "I'm fighting the Battle of Britain, and on its outcome depends the fate of the world." The fact is, the average fighter pilot at the time just thought he was doing his everyday job. One squadron leader said this:
"At the time, we didn't know that it was a vital battle. We thought that that was the way war was fought. You know, it was fighting every day and you just carried on. We didn't know we were quite so close to defeat either. Because down at the squadron level, pilot level, we didn't know how short we were of aircraft and of pilot replacements. We didn't have the overall picture. We were just young boys. I was 23 and I was one of the experienced ones."
How easy it is to underestimate how much our daily battles impact the work of God. But the tougher that each of us is individually, the greater, the stronger this work will be. David, that young man who single-handedly stood up to the giant Goliath, when he became king, he inspired the men under him. 2 Samuel 21 lists the mighty men who served in his command. And it came to pass after this that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibbecai the Hushathite slew Saph, which was one of the sons of the giant. And there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanan a Bethlehemite slew the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was yet a battle in Gath, where there was a man of great stature that had on every hand 6 fingers and on every foot 6 toes, 24 in number. And he also was born to the giant. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, the brother of David, slew him. Why did Israel become so great under David? Gerald Fleury asks. These men wanted to do all they could to help their king. They killed giants, just as David did. This faithful attitude came from David right on down through his generals. This is how we can become the greatest possible church. Follow the faith of the man God is using to lead spiritual Israel. We all need to be giant killers. God makes that possible for every one of us. That is how the body of Christ will become powerful and accomplish amazing things. It's not enough that David be great. Everybody under him must be great. That is what is required if we're to have a great church. There can be no breakdown in any link. This towering lesson in government is what will help us finish the work with real strength. Not enough can be said for the few, the pilots of fighter command who never considered defeat, and who outdid themselves in combat, knowing all along that theirs was a just cause. Anne Turley George was the wife of a former fighter pilot. She said this about the Battle of Britain:
"We lay in ditches and watched the dogfights and cheered on our warriors and laughed and danced and sang with them in the evenings and saw them off the next day, with the tight fist of fear knotted deep in our insides. And more fell. They held our lives, our happiness, and our heritage in their young, strong hands. And they never flinched. I wish I could write music. I would create one great triumphant shout of a hymn, praising and honoring them, and telling of our love and gratitude to them forever and ever. Amen."
God wants us to take the victory. We are fighting so that all Britain, all Europe, all nations and peoples around the world may be free, that the life of the world may move into broad, sunlit uplands. And what love and gratitude they will have when we take the victory. For eternity, we'll enjoy the praise and honor of our spiritual children and all the people of this world because of the warfare we are waging today. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that when this empire lasts for 1,000 years and beyond, men will say, "This was their finest hour." I'm Joel Hilliker, and that concludes today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory, there is no survival. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.